Hey, Cam, where do you go? Oh, he overachieved in providing water for my. Yeah, I kind of spill all over. I need a napkin or something, paper towel, dry me off here. Turn to Genesis chapter 1, and let's kind of go back over the days of creation and what happened on each day. And I'm going to try to go through this in a fairly straightforward fashion. I've got a little presentation at the end when we bring the children up, and they'll take a look at that. Carla and Sylvia have already seen it, so no fair cheating. But I'm trying to get as much mileage out of that as I can, because it just so happens that we're looking at the same material. So we looked at creation in general. We talked about the spiritual world, how God has angels and how he created them, the different types of angels. There's cherubims, there's seraphims, how they're different, things that they can do, things they cannot do. And then we looked at this account in Genesis 1 about the days of creation, that in fact it was 6 days, not long periods of time, not theistic evolution, none of that stuff. We talked about why the Bible insists on 24-hour days, that God out of nothing created everything. The evolutionary idea is that nobody times nothing made everything, which is nonsense. That just doesn't work. So we get to the first day in Genesis 1. And as I read it, I want you to think about what was created, because I've got a short question for you. And you can tell me what was in fact created, right? So Genesis 1, I'm going to read the first 5 verses. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void. And darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. It's interesting, in the Hebrew it's one word, just light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. So my question is, what was created the first day?
Earth.
Earth?
And heaven.
Heaven? What else? There's 5 things.
Then light.
Water. He divided the water from the earth.
He didn't divide the water just yet. That comes later. But yes, so he's got we've got earth, heavens, water, light, and one other thing.
Darkness.
Yeah, you don't think of darkness as something that's been created. If you were to describe to a child what is darkness, how would you describe darkness to a child?
Show him a room when it's dark, there's no light in there.
Okay, no light. And that is what darkness is. It's the absence of light. It's interesting that darkness can't get rid of light. The only way that you get rid of light is you have to eliminate the light source. But light penetrates darkness. It drives darkness away. So it's interesting that there's that property, if you've ever thought about that in that way. Also, I noticed that there's a lot of separation. Did you see that? There was the light, there was darkness, and he divided the light, verse 4, from the darkness. There was a division made. They don't blend together. You have a complete separation of the two. So that's interesting, because I think we'll see that show up more. Now, the light of day 1, where it says God called the light day and the darkness he called night, this has been a source of ridicule for a while by the theistic evolutionary crowd, or the evolutionary crowd. And they mock it because of the listing of the light source in day 4. You read about that in verse 16. God made 2 great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. And of course, he's talking about our sun and the moon. Those are the 2 great lights that we have. The moon has what kind of a light? What kind of light does the moon have? It's a reflected light. It doesn't emanate light on its own. We know the moon doesn't burn. It just simply serves as a big mirror, and it reflects light. You know, you can get a moon burn. You can actually lay out on the beach at night and expose your, you know, parts of your body to the moon, and people can get a literal moon burn. You can actually get a burn even off the reflected light. I thought that was interesting. But this has been a source of ridicule by the evolutionists, because they say, well, see, which one came first, light or the sun? And frankly, science itself proves that light doesn't find its sole source from the sun, but its emanation. It's an emanation of waves and or particles produced by energized electrons. That's what causes light. It's a certain range of the electromagnetic spectrum is where you find light coming out. And it's whatever source causes that. But that principle, that harnessing of all of these things coming together to form something that can hit our eyeballs and become light, that concept wasn't there, and that's what God created. In Genesis 1:3 is the word light. That's the word ore in the Hebrew, if I'm pronouncing that right. And in verse 14, it says, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven. That word light there is ma-ore, which means light bearer. So actually, when science finally caught up, the Bible is actually describing a very good explanation, a very good scientific explanation. There's light, and then there's a light bearer. And that's what it has been discovered to be. It bears light. It creates light. And I came across some interesting facts about the sun. I was trying to scan through this here, and unfortunately it printed out on my printer on like 6.5-point font. And so I'm going to strain my eyes to try to read this thing. But there were some interesting facts, I thought, that were just amazing to me about the sun, that if you were to drive, if you were to ride in a high-speed train, now, of course, the sun would melt it, but if you could be in a high-speed train going right through the middle of the sun from one side to the other at 100 miles an hour, it would take you over a year to get from one side to the other. That's how massive the sun is. It's the size of 393,000 Earths. It's just utterly huge. If you were to try to drive on that same high-speed train from Earth to reach the sun, it would take you 100 years at that same speed. It's 93 million miles away. That's almost incomprehensible for us to understand. You see these little solar models as a kid where you put a big orange basketball in the middle and these little popcorn ball-sized things farther out. It doesn't do it justice because it's not the scale. It's a tremendously far distance away. But oh, what a perfect distance it's set at. It produces just the right amount of heat. It's very efficient. And it's unusual among other planets, or excuse me, other stars that give off energy. Scientists will tell you our sun is like a star, and they will falsely tell you, well, it's just like any old other star. Hardly. It really is not. It's very unique. Now, I know I'm talking about the light of the fourth day, but I wanted to kind of spend a little time on that. Most stars in the universe are actually binary pairs. They come in pairs, and they rotate around each other. And they put out so much energy in that vicinity that they are unstable in their orbit. Their energy plays off of each other, and it varies in intensity over time, wildly. And any planet trying to live near that would face wild fluctuations in the amount of energy coming out. We have solar flares that hit us from time to time, and it can cause electronic disruptions. Those who are sensitive to that with certain types of electronic equipment will certainly know about those. But our sun is very stable. It doesn't produce these wild flares. It's a very stable source. It has a very consistent temperature that it gives to us, and so it, as it were, seems to be just custom fit for our purposes. And it's got a very reliable fuel source, very efficient. I think somewhere in here I read that this is of interest to me. I'm not sure if I can put my finger on it quickly, but it talked about 1 square yard of sun puts out 700,000 watts of power, you know, per hour, some phenomenal amount like that. It was just some incredible power ratio that it puts out. And that's what drives our planet. That's what gives us our plants. That's what warms the ocean. That's what heats us. Obviously, without that, we would just be a frozen ball in space and there wouldn't be anything to talk about. So that is the marvelous thing that God created there. You also notice back in Genesis 1, at the creation of light, now again, I'm not talking about the sun, I'm going back to the first day, this alternation of light and darkness can occur if you have a spinning ball. God creates light, yet say this microphone here would be a light source, and if you have a spinning ball that God created the earth, you would see 24-hour periods of light and darkness. So there's no problem there at all. That would be a 24-hour period. All right, let's go to the second day, and I'll have another question for you. And that's verses 6 through 8. So Genesis 1, 6 to 8. Dan, if I could trouble you to read those verses there, I'd be grateful.
And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. And the evening and morning were the second day.
So that's interesting. Now we have something called a firmament. Any idea what a firmament is? Candace, you look like you know.
Sky.
Sky, okay. Be a little more precise.
The
yes, the atmosphere, exactly. Yeah, it's the atmosphere. You know, that's something else that's very unique to our planet, is that we have this protective bubble called an atmosphere. There are other planets that have atmospheres. Mercury has an atmosphere. It's way too hot. It, in fact, encapsulates, I think I'm getting the planets correct here. Let's see, which is the one that has, yeah, Mercury they thought was gone. It actually has a very tiny bit of atmosphere there, so that planet is very cold. On the other hand, Venus has an atmosphere, and it is so hot, it's so thick, that it bakes the planet. It encapsulates it in sulfuric acid. It's just very inhospitable. You really wouldn't want to be there at all. It captures all of the light, and nothing gets out. All the energy stays in. It's just boiling hot on the surface there. You'd just be totally overwhelmed by the gases there. And it seems like a planet's atmosphere, according to ICR, I've got another paper here from Institute for Creation Research, they said the atmosphere of a planet appears to be tied to its geology, the structure of the planet itself, and that there's an interplay between tidal reactions and volcanoes, because when a volcano explodes, what does it do? It throws a bunch of junk up into the atmosphere, and that has an impact on it. I'm reading a quote here. Scientists are now realizing that delicate balance is required. A dynamic crust is vital to the atmosphere's stability, but too much tidal activity, like on Jupiter's moon Io, can smother any life. This means you have to have a tidal habitable zone and a UV, ultraviolet habitable zone, to constrain the habitable zone where temperature permits liquid water. So you have to have these three habitable zones all lined up nicely for life to be there. So the atmosphere is very important. It protects us in many ways. It keeps a lot of the harmful rays from the sun out. Have you heard of gamma radiation? That's what you get from X-rays. You get it from atomic bomb, and you get a lot of it with an atomic bomb. And that's what obliterates people. It causes all kinds of cancer and horrible diseases. The sun pumps that out in volume. Yet our atmosphere blocks all that. If you go really far north to Canada or very far south, and you look up, you'll see something called the Aurora Borealis. There's all these, they're called northern lights. They're very colorful. And what that is the spew of ions that are coming out of the sun, these highly charged, high-energy particles, and they hit our magnetic shield, which is part of our atmosphere, and it blocks it from the Earth, and it kind of traps it up in that northern part there. So we have a marvelous thing that protects us. You know what else it protects us from? You ever heard of meteorites and asteroids and things of that nature, little space rocks flying around? Well, if you didn't have an atmosphere, guess what? You'd have all kinds of space junk falling on your head. But the atmosphere, in fact, is quite firm, exactly the way the Bible describes it. It's a firmament. Certainly our engineers who deal with rockets have learned that when you put something up in space, you need to protect it, because when it comes back in, and gravity's pulling it in, and it ever increases in its speed, it's increasing very, very rapidly, and it hits that atmosphere. If it doesn't have protection on it, it'll burn up. The atmosphere does a very good job of burning up things that fall to the Earth, and so it protects us in that way. Now, it's not, what are these waters? Well, yes, our atmosphere. So they're clouds. It's not a sea of glass. Some have said, well, that must be the sea of glass that you read about from Revelation chapter 6. No, it's not that. It's not a river of life. It's not a solid vault. Some people have speculated that the Earth first had a water layer, a canopy above it, that was then the source of all the water for the flood of Noah's day. And that won't work either, because you'd have to have way too much water, and that canopy would be way too thick, and we wouldn't have normal life functions. Most of the water came from underneath the earth. There were large subterranean chambers, and when the earth split and cracked open in the middle, all the water came out. And that's why God says, I'll never do it again, because all the water that was underneath there came out already. So that's what happened on our second day, and that's our firmament. Then we go to our third day, and verses 9 to 13. And Chris, if you would you like to read that?
And God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth, and it was so. And the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the third day.
Yeah, thanks. So now we have another day of separation here. Did you notice that? He keeps talking about separating. Verse 6, let it divide the waters from the waters. Verse 9, let them be gathered. And as he was gathering, he's separating the waters into one place, and he's separating it from the dry land. There's all this separation going on. When I first read through this and I noticed this word divide appearing quite a lot, I thought, now that's interesting. I would expect, if I were making a creation account, and of course I haven't written any and I don't think I could, I know I couldn't, I would maybe use words like add or multiply. I'm not sure I'd use the word divide, because when you divide something, you're cutting it in half, and you'd think that you're making it smaller. You know, isn't it interesting? When God divides, it tends to multiply. Think about the loaves and the fishes and the bread. He took them, he gave thanks, and he divided it, and he gave it to his disciples. What happened? Well, by doing that, man, everybody was fed. See, God has different ways of doing things to multiply for his people. His way, his course of multiplication is called division. And you would look at that and go, how can that benefit? It was true even in the Church of God when it first started. The church was first centralized in Jerusalem, and you read about it in Acts 8 that a man named Saul of Tarsus, was wreaking havoc on the church, and he captured a lot of the brethren, and he put a lot of them in prison. And it wreaked havoc, and the church, meaning the laity, the person in the pew, went everywhere, preaching the word of God. The apostles were stuck in Jerusalem, but it was the church members at the time who went abroad. God was dividing in order to multiply. He was spreading it forth. So this is a technique he uses to multiply things. I find that very interesting. Well, he has now sea from dry land. Let's just flip for a moment to Psalm 104 and verses 8 and 9. Psalm 104 and verses 8 and 9. Psalm 104 and verse 8, it says this, they go up by the mountains, they go down by the valleys unto the place which thou hast founded for them. He's speaking about the earth here. Thou hast set a bound that they might not pass over, that they turn not again to cover the earth. So he's speaking about how God has laid this foundation for the waters, and he has established a certain region that waters can and cannot go. He puts a boundary to those things. He speaks even of the sea, that their proud waves can only come so far. Now, it's a parable going on there, but we also see it the case of oceans and landforms. He's set those boundaries as to where they may go. There's three great classes back in Genesis 1 of things that he made. He made grass, that would be flowerless plants, plant that didn't produce a flower, doesn't produce any fruit, no seed, it just has green leaves on it. There's herbs, that can also be vegetables, that can be grain that yields seed. It's not just what you and I would call herbs, like an herbal tincture, it's more than that. And also fruit trees, and boy, aren't we glad for fruit trees. This is an interesting thing that God now produces. It uses this phrase, whose seed is in itself. I'm always impressed by the variety of seeds that are out there. As you, some of you know, we homeschool our children, and I had the privilege to teach my children a introductory to life sciences class when they were, ninth grade. I think Victoria was seventh grade, and we were studying at one point about seeds. And it was very interesting how a seed is made. They kind of have you do a dissection of a seed. You know, you think about frogs, but have you ever dissected a seed? It has this hard outer shell that they refer to it as a jacket or a coat, and it's very protective. In fact, it's so protective, birds can eat it. It goes right through their digestive system, and it doesn't destroy the seed. Pretty impressive. Same thing with humans or dogs or other animals that might eat that fruit. The digestive system doesn't destroy that seed. That's a pretty tough jacket. But given the right conditions of just a simple amount of water, and you would think there's plenty of water in when you drink, but it doesn't. It protects against that. Given the right moisture and the temperature, not light, it doesn't need light, it'll spring forth and it'll crack open. And inside that seed, it's got a little miniature version of itself, and it's got a little tiny bit of food, just enough food to feed it. And the whole cycle starts all over again. That's quite impressive. I think that's a very impressive design. You know, the corn that you and I eat and the types of trees we look at, unless they've been hybridized and somebody has crossed them with other types of cherry trees or things like that, are essentially the same that Adam and Eve saw. They're still fundamentally plants that have that seed within them that replicates. And I haven't done anything like that. I've never been able to make something that can reproduce itself, not even as a software program, that would last through the millennia. You think about how long, and under such a wide range of conditions. One of the most fascinating seeds to me is a coconut seed. This thing can float in salt water on an ocean for thousands of miles. Now, you know how rough salt water is to any kind of plant. You want to kill a plant, put salt water on it. That's a pretty sure way to get rid of it. This coconut can float for thousands of miles across the surface of the ocean, and it lands finally on some beach somewhere, and it hits that sand, and it gets partially submerged, and I don't know what triggers inside of it, but that's exactly where it's going to crack out a root, and you have a palm tree that shows up, a coconut tree that shows up. How can that thing do that? I'm just highly impressed by those kind of things. You study more and more about seeds. What about dandelions? I'm still stuck on this subject. I'm fascinated by it. Here's a seed that has its own parasail. It has these little tiny veins, these little tiny whisk-like feathers, not feathers, but they're just little tiny sticks, basically, that are almost spider web thin. And as soon as the wind blows, off it goes. And, you know, I just see it across my lawn. I think, oh, did I put out weed poison or not? I mean, and these things just fly for long, long distances. They a floating seed. Other mechanisms removal have seeds that have burrs in them, so they get on the sides of animals, and they're transported great distance. Other seeds have this interesting mechanism where as they dry, they come under tension. And it becomes so much tension that it explodes and it shoots the seed 30, 40 feet away. It has a way of sending the seed off a far distance. There's such a wide variety of seeds. Our God has no limit to his imagination. So here the earth is putting forth grass. Now, when we read the earth, let the earth bring forth grass, does not mean let the dirt develop by its own inherent force over millions of years into vegetables. That's not what that can be construed to mean. Hardly will the dirt, will a rock stick its head up and say, you know, I'm tired of being a rock, I think I'll be a vegetable right about now. I think I really need to be producing some tomatoes. This is nonsense. You can't be a Christian and believe the Bible and think that evolution can somehow fit in here. It doesn't fit. It won't fit if you're going to try to be consistent with the Scriptures. In Genesis 2:9, if you skip ahead to the next chapter, which we'll briefly discuss at the end, it said, out of the ground the Lord God made to grow every tree. God is the one that made it to grow out of the ground. The ground didn't come up with the idea. It didn't think this thing through. There's no DNA in dirt. It's something that God did. Lastly, God said he made these trees after his kind. You know, some trees can cross-pollinate, others can't. After their kind means that there's a unique distinction between them. Now, it's not equivalent to our species. There's hundreds of species of all kinds of trees and different types of flowers. I think the iris has the most number of species that are out there. But that's not what is talked about here. We're not talking about species. Kind has to do with the fact that I can't take a pecan and cross it with, say, a fruit tree, and get a fracon, or I don't know what you would call it, you're not going to get that. It just won't match. So there is a specific limit within that, and it's hard for us to understand where that kind variation is. I'll talk more about that when we get to the animals here. Okay, that's the third day. Fourth day. Now you've got the sun, the moon, and the stars as light bearers, and there's four purposes. See if you can pick out these four purposes as I read this passage on the fourth day. So let's start in verse 14. Sorry, I had to finish off my coffee there. God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the light from the night. Let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. Let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth, and it was so." And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the fourth day. All right, what are the four purposes for the light bearers, sun, moon, and stars?
Signs, seasons, days, years.
Yep, signs, seasons, to divide the day from the night. Yep. So the days and years, that would be the seasons, days, and years, that I think would be one purpose. Signs, yes, to divide day from night. There's a fourth one. Maybe it's too obvious.
To give light.
What'd you say?
To give light.
To give light, yes, light for the earth. Mm-hmm. Now, both are luminaries, obviously, but and we're more appreciative of the sun. But in fact, both lights support plant development. There are some plants, I found out, such as the evening primrose, the devil's trumpet, the white moonflower vine, lamb's ears, and lady of the night orchids only bloom after dusk. It's the light of the moon that causes those plants to bloom. So they couldn't work unless there was a nighttime light bearer. And so that's when they come forth. And of course, they've got to be pollinated. So that means there has to be a creature that can see well that flower in the night, and it just goes on. God builds all this up, and it just didn't come out. It just isn't there. Now, there are those who are allegedly Christian ministers and are also so-called scientists. One of those fellows is a man named Dr. Hugh Ross. He has a ministry called Reasons to Believe. And he believes that God simply dismissed the clouds on the fourth day so that the sun and the stars that were already there could now appear on the earth. So he believes the stars, because again, he's trying to force a atheistic evolutionary view of how the universe came into being. He says, well, those were created first, and it was just a big cloudy day for a long time before God dispelled the clouds, and then they all of a sudden revealed the sun and the stars. That would be a big problem for several reasons. One, that would be the one day God actually didn't create anything. He would just have removed something that was blocking the vision. That's not the word used here. He's talking about God made two great lights, that same word used elsewhere. He made it out of nothing. He created these things. He spoke it into existence. It's not something that was just hidden from them and they didn't realize it was there. There's other crazy ideas like that as well, but I'm not going to go into all those. I do want to get to the fifth day and the sixth and the seventh, and then I want to save time for the kids when they can come up, because I've got a little slideshow presentation for them. I hope they enjoy that. So for the fifth day, it was the creation of the birds and fishes, and we read about that here. Now, let me read that for you in verse 20. Genesis 1:20. God said, "Let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life, and fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. And God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind." Notice that again. "And every winged fowl after his kind, and God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, Be fruitful and multiply, fill the waters in the seas, and let fowl multiply in the earth in the evening and the morning of the fifth day." Now, what's interesting about the creation of birds and fishes is that from an engineering point of view, both are designed to move very efficiently through a fluid. The air looks very much like a fluid. If you watch it in slow motion, if you've ever seen slow motion photography of a storm coming into a city, somebody sets a camera out there that takes a picture once every a minute or so, the clouds look very water-like. It's just that they're moving at a much slower pace than physical water does. But they're both a fluid medium. When they study how a plane flies, they're looking at a vehicle through a fluid medium. They're both unstable on solid ground, whether it's a fish or a bird. They're really kind of flopping around. I know there's a few fish, like a walking catfish, that can lumber around, or seals and walruses that can somewhat be mobile on land, and some birds can run around quite a lot. But for the most part, their home really is in the air and the water. I'm sure you've seen penguins at the zoo. They're quite fascinating. They just kind of totter around back and forth, and boy, when they get in that water, they acrobatic. You know, they move with incredible speed. They just seem to flip those stiff little fins, and they can zip around the water at incredible paces. Very creative how our Lord has done this. They both have comparable methods of procreation, and again, they were both created after their kind. One did not develop from the other. It doesn't say, let the birds bring forth fish or let the fish bring forth birds. That can't be. Structurally, they're both very, very different. Fish bones are more like cartilage. They're solid, but they're very flexible and bendy. They don't seem to hurt that way. A shark has no bones in his body, and he also never stops moving. When he stops moving, he's dead. Birds, on the other hand, have very hollow bones, and they have these very strange little cross-section members in them that are like girders like trusses, building trusses that have all these cross membranes. By being hollow, it reduces the weight, and with the trusses inside, the little cross members, they're very strong. Wouldn't you love to be a bird in rush hour traffic just to lift out your wings and get above all of this stuff and just fly out of there and just be able to freely move around? It says, they that wait upon the Lord shall mount up with wings as eagles. So who knows? Someday we may be able to do that. Maybe we just lost our feathers. I don't know. But what an amazing creature those birds are. They're very, very different from each other. The bird breathes air. What I find impressive is the geese. You ever notice geese? Now, pay attention to this the next time you see geese coming, because we're coming up on the fall and we're going to see some geese coming in soon. I like it when they fly overhead. You know, like these low-life flying bombers that, you know, they just kind of barely flap their wings and they're just moving right along, really. But when you watch them land, watch them when they land and they stop and they start walking around. Now, they're kind of not really huffing and puffing real hard. I mean, they just flew a really long distance. Have you ever run anything close to a mile? Have you ever tried to run like a quarter of a mile? You know, you run a quarter of a mile. I mean, we got legs, you know, we got muscles in our legs. We can run. And you do that, and, you know, boy, at the end of that, you're just, you know, begging for oxygen and water. I mean, it's a hard run. That goose lands, and he's not huffing and puffing and trying to suck in air. You know why? Because he has a very interesting mechanism for breath. He actually breathes when he inhales and when he exhales. Both directions still introduce oxygen into his system, both with the upstroke of the wing and the downstroke. It's, I mean, I have to go in and out, but he doesn't. He's got a very unique system so that he's well oxygenated as a result of that. God designed him so that he has no problem whatsoever. He could fly 200, 300 miles and land and walk around and not be out of breath. He's still got plenty of energy to honk. I think it's impressive. Yeah, I've never noticed that until somebody pointed that out in a book. Hey, you know what? Geese aren't panting like you and I when they land. Again, very different. How does a fish who needs gills to pull oxygen out of the water, how does he develop lungs that are very efficient in pulling oxygen out of the air? How does that work? The first fish flops out on the land, he dies. What did he learn? Nothing. The next fish flops out on the land. He can't breathe because he doesn't have lungs. He dies. What did he learn? You can't get there from here. Fish don't create birds, and birds can't just decide to start sucking in water. It doesn't work. You don't find any kind of crossbreeding there between the birds and the fishes. All right, now we go on to the sixth day, the climactic day of creation, and that's in 24 to 31. I'll just read the key parts of it that I want to hit on. 24 says this, God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after his kind, and it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after his kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let him have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. He tells them to be fruitful and multiply. Verse 29, he says, I've given you every herb bearing seed, the fruit of the tree. You can eat that. We started off as vegetarians. You're not killing a tree when you eat it or a fruit. There was no death. Animals would have lived forever, just as humans would have. But trees and plants, we could eat that. So would the creatures. Creatures would eat that too. Every beast of the earth, every fowl of the air, everything that creeps upon the earth, I've given every green herb for meat. So God also fed the creatures with plants. Now some people say, well, wait a minute. Lion. I mean, that lion's got big, big teeth. God gave that lion big teeth. Obviously, that big teeth means he's a meat eater. Because look what he does. He attacks things. Well, let me tell you what really, really big teeth means in an animal. When you see an animal with really big teeth, what that means is God gave him big teeth. That's all it means. A panda bear has large teeth, too, but he's quite content to eat bamboo. Yeah, he loves to eat bamboos. And you know what? Bamboo's pretty thick. Have you ever tried to cut bamboo? You need something kind of sharp. There's stories, real accounts, I should say, not a story because it's not fictional, of lions. Some lions have been raised in captivity on milk. They were cubs when they were caught. The mother died or something, and they brought this little cub in, and they fed it milk. And you know what? That lion was quite content to drink milk all of his life. He's quite content with that. So the early creatures were all plant-eating creatures. Just because they had big teeth doesn't mean that they were not that they had to be carnivorous. They could have absolutely eaten plants, just like the big panda bear does. Now, let the earth bring forth does not mean, again, let dirt develop into animals by their own inherent force. The rock isn't going to say, I think I'll be a gorilla today. Not going to happen. Evolutionists don't believe that animals came directly from mineral materials anyway. So this presents a problem to those who want to hold a theistic evolutionary view. I'm throwing some terms about here, but let me do a quick check. When I say theistic evolution, do you know what I'm talking about? Does that make any sense? So evolution is from the goo to the zoo to you, right? That's what evolution is, that these quote so-called random processes over long periods of time somehow allowed matter to just self-organize into very highly complex things like a human being. Theistic evolution tries to find a way to say, well, I hear the scientists and I don't know how to refute them, and they're pretty smart guys and they're on television and they look like they're very professional and they speak very eloquent, so I don't know how to defeat them. So they must be right. They don't believe God, I know that. But I believe God. So what I think is that the scientists have simply figured out how God created everything. They don't believe God. They don't know God is behind it all, but God must be behind it, and he just happened to use evolution to do that. So they try to find a way to put their foot in both camp and say, I'll make peace with both of them. I'm good with that. Well, theistic evolution is a big problem because the Bible won't let you go down that path. It doesn't present anything in here. There's no language in here that allows that. And of course, the evolutionist is quite happy to let you talk about that, because as long as you accept his science, which, by the way, insists that he'll look at everything except for anything that might lead to God. If there's any evidence that possibly leads to a designer, I'm going to rule that out of hand. I'm just not going to go down. I a priori will not entertain that idea. Well, that doesn't sound like coming at it with an open mind. That doesn't sound like going to where the data may lead you to. That doesn't sound very open to me, and it's not. It's a mechanism, a tool of the devil. He's very content to make you think that you came from rocks or baboons or birds or fish or something stupid like that. The creation of man is very different from animals. God said, "Let us make man in our own image." Man has a soul, animals do not. Sorry to burst your bubble, there's no puppies in heaven. That favored pet you had, sorry, he goes to the earth and that's the end of that animal. Now there's other strange views about this, but I'm not going to talk about those. I do have a paper if you're interested in some of these other views on the days of creation. I've got copies, you can read that in your own time, and it's kind of more scholarly type, but it's not something I would want to sit and teach through. But then there's the seventh day itself in Genesis 2. And what we find here is God says in verse 1, "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day God ended his work which he made. He rested on the seventh day from all his work which he made. God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he had rested from all his work which God created and made." The negative, the negative is that no work was done on this day on purpose. The positive is that God took delight in his completed work. He saw everything and he delighted in it. He was happy about it. God saw everything good, everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. I'm going to read a quote from a theologian who made an interesting observation. He says this, "Like the rest of an artist, gazing on his masterpiece, finding perfect satisfaction in the contemplation of his production. It answered the purpose of God and corresponded to the divine ideal. And so he rejoices in his creation, for in it he recognizes the reflection of his glorious perfections. His radiant countenance shines upon it and is productive of showers of blessing." So the Lord God took time to stop and look and admire. And of course he did that for a reason. We know why he did that. Years later, when Moses would receive from God, written by the finger of God on tablets of stone, the Ten Commandments, the fourth commandment, which would have taken up a third of the tablets of the writing on it, was the commandment to rest on the Sabbath, the seventh day, because that's the day that God rested. Why do we rest from our work after 6 days? Because God rested. You know, some people are workaholics. They would work around the clock. Turns out your body is very much set up for a 7-day work cycle. I remember doing a study on sleep, and the reason I was doing this study is I was having a hard time sleeping. And I was trying to figure out, is there something I can do to improve my sleep? What am I doing wrong? And certain foods to avoid at night and all that sort of thing. Well, it turns out that when you sleep at night, there's different phases you go through. And they're about 90 minutes long. You go into this deep cycle for 90 minutes, and then your body kind of wakes up a little bit. And then it goes down into another 90-minute cycle, and it wakes up again. And you have about, on a good night's sleep, you'll have 5 of those, at least 5. So that gets you close to your 7.5, 8 hours of sleep. Now, younger people need more sleep, obviously, and older people need less sleep. But in general, that's the nature of those cycles. It turns out the first 4 cycles do something very important. Say you were doing something in the garden and you cut your hand on a thorn or something and you got a tear in your skin. Well, those first 4 cycles are all about doing body repair. It fixes the body. You're stopped, you're not moving, great time to set up a repair shop. It starts to do the healing of the physical body. But the very last cycle is the one that refreshes your mind. That's when it goes through and starts to refresh your brain and to improve things. And, I'm a computer guy. It's like defragging the hard drive, okay? It's like going through and tossing out and reclaiming bits and replacing things and just cleaning up your mind and refreshing it. Have you ever woken up after a very short night's sleep and you still kind of feel foggy and, you know, physically you're able to operate, but you just felt like you just didn't quite get enough sleep? Well, that's because you missed that very last cycle. You know how long you can go with that? Well, you can actually go 6 days missing that last cycle and still function. But the seventh day You got to get it. You really got to get a good night's sleep that seventh day, or some significant damage starts to occur to the body. Isn't that interesting? We finally figured out, after all these years, God had it right. You just got to rest the seventh day. You just got to recharge. You know, the Mexicans have it right. You know, they take a siesta in the middle of the day and sleep because it's too blooming hot. And there's a lot to be said for that. Edison did the same thing. He was fired from a job because he was napping. But he was a tremendous inventor. He was giving his brain a rest. He was letting his cells recharge so he could think clearly. Yeah, we're sleep deprived. It's ridiculous. There's nothing wrong with rest. Sometimes the body just simply has to recharge. You have to give enough time to do that. And so God did that because he knows that man by nature is going to want to work himself to death. And you've just got to stop and rest. And so it's a tremendous benefit to us. All right, well, I'm at the, what am I? I'm at the 45-minute mark, and I have a little 15-minute thing I want to show, but I want to have the kids in here for this.
Footsteps.
Ah, here comes the footsteps. Here comes the herd. There's Victoria. There's Katie. Okay, alrighty, we are in Genesis, and Mr. Kluth has a little presentation here for you, and some of the Bible Bee people have been studying the book of Genesis, and so this is a chance, see, you can see it over there. Yeah, there's nothing fun here, it's all up there. Yeah, all the good stuff's up there. Yeah, don't look behind the curtain here, just look over there. Right? Okay, the real deal here, let's go on. Okay, so where do you think all of this stuff came from? Let's look at that. What is that? What do you think that is? You've seen it. Tornado? Yeah, it does look like a tornado, doesn't it? Oh, yeah. Well, it's actually not. Cam, what do you think that is?
A galaxy.
That is a galaxy. Yeah, you know what a galaxy is? It's a bunch of stars and a bunch of other galaxies. In fact, that little bitty dot that you see right down there in the corner, that little dot is another galaxy too. It's just further away. There's billions and billions of stars, and there's galaxies, and there's supposedly billions of galaxies out there. Where do you think all that came from? What about this? Where do you think that came from? What is that?
Earth.
Yeah, that's Earth. You know what that is, Katie? Earth. Yeah, what's that thing behind Earth? What's that little...
Moon.
That's right. That's the moon that's behind the Earth. Yeah. Look at that. And it's kind of got a nice little atmosphere around it. Isn't that pretty cool? Okay. What about that? What is that thing?
It's a platypus.
Very good. It's a duck-billed platypus. Now, that is a very interesting creature. He has a bill like a duck. Quack, quack. He has webbed feet in the front. He has claws in the back. He has a tail like a beaver. And he bears eggs. And the eggs hatch and they nurse. So it's a mammal that lives underwater. That is a Franken creature. I think God created him out of all the parts of the other animals to say, wait till the evolutionists get a hold of this. I think he just really wanted to. You know what? We can go in even closer. What is that? What do you think those squiggly things are? Hint, you can't eat them. You don't want to eat those things.
Worms.
Huh? Worms? Well, I guess they're worms. Huh? A spirochete. Well, Mr. Professional Microbiologist over here is going to give us the 12-cylinder word. It's a spirochete. Wow, we know them as bacteria. Yeah, they're bacteria. They're bugs. And, hey, look at that thing. What is that thing sticking out of his tail? You know what that is? That's his propeller. That's how he moves. You know what's interesting about that? Look at how that thing is made. It's got bearings. It's got a rotor, stators, it's got a bushing, a U-joint, it's got a flange, and it's very tiny. It can turn 10,000 RPMs and stop in a quarter of a turn and go the other direction. That looks like a motor, a high-speed motor, and it is. Who made all that stuff? Yeah, who made all that stuff? That didn't just evolve out of dirt and rocks. You ever been walking around the beach and see a laptop sitting there in the dirt halfway, and you say, wow, look at what the pounding of the waves did. It made an Intel processor and a computer. That's great. If we wait here another 3 weeks, we'll have an upgraded laptop. No, you'd say that's ridiculous. Obviously, somebody left their poor laptop behind and it's getting soaked in the dirt. You wouldn't say. If you came across an Indian arrowhead in the ground, would you say that rock just somehow carved itself? No, you'd say somebody's been chipping away at this thing. It's got purpose, it's got symmetry, it's got point, sharp edge, evidence of designs all around us. It's in God's creation in the galaxies, it's in God's creation in the duck-billed platypus, and you keep going deeper and deeper and deeper and zoom in and zoom in and zoom in, and you see his handiwork even down to the bushings on the, what did you call it? What did you call that thing?
That part's called the flagellum.
But the other...
Spirochete.
Spirochete. Even in the spirochete's tail, you can see some design. All right. So who is right? There's the Bible. Or these ungodly men. They say, the guys on the left, I should have put the bad guys on the left, the Bible says that God created all things in the space of 6 days. These ungodly men on the right says it all just came out of matter and dirt and it just happened. It was a big bang, poof, and everything just came along. All right? Well, they say nobody times nothing is everything. You ever done math? Okay, let's hold up our hands. How much is nobody? How many people is nobody? How much? Is it 10, Katie? Allie's got it. Zero. All right, how much is nothing? Katie, 7 is nothing? No, you're destined for Harvard, I can tell. What is 0? 0 times 0 is what?
0.
0. Yeah, how do you get everything from 0 times 0? That makes no sense whatsoever. So these guys, were they actually there? Were they actually there? Can they repeat the experiment? Can you say, hey, I'm going to go create everything in the lab today? Well, no, you can't do that experiment. They're not there. There's no experiment they can do. But God was there, and he told us about it. He gave us some information about it. In 6 days, the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. He was there. All right. Now let's review the creation days real quick, shall we? Okay. What's on day one? Anybody remember?
Heaven and earth.
Heaven and earth, yep. And what else? What's the big thing?
Light.
Yeah, light. God separated light from darkness. Yeah, heaven and earth was there too. What's day two? Remember? Day two. Separated the waters from the waters. That's what made our atmosphere. We call it a firmament. All right, what was day three? Water went to one place and land came with vegetation. Okay. What was day four? He had the sun and the moon and the stars. AIL came out. What was day five?
Sea creatures
and flying creatures. That's right. Very good. Somebody's remembering. All right. What was day six?
Land, animals, and man.
Land, animals, and man. God creates man and the land animals. That's right. All right. And day seven, what did he make day seven?
He
made a hammock. That's right. He rested that day. I like that day. That's one of my favorite days.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. All right. Now let's ask some questions. Which came first, the earth or the sun? Think the earth? How many say the earth? How many say the sun? That's right. The earth came first. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. It was without form and void. And then later on day four, he made two great lights. Then the sun came. So he made the earth first. Now, what's really strange, and this is where your evolutionary friends are going to have a problem, is they say, the ungodly say, the stars and the sun came before the earth. Well, that's not right. That's contrary to what God's Word says. All right, next one. The earth was first covered with what?
Water.
All right, very good. It says the earth was without form and void, darkness on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the waters. It was totally full of water. Lots of water. Lots and lots and lots of water. All the water came first. Now, the ungodly say the earth was a hot, molten blob. Didn't have water. It was a big, hot, molten blob. Well, that doesn't sound very nice. If you're a hot, molten blob, what happens when it dries? It dries and it's really hard. Where's the water going to go? Yeah, that monkey's laughing. He says, that's kind of ridiculous, sir. That's not going to work.
How did it get hot?
Huh?
How did it get hot?
Well, because there was a bang. Right. All right, which came first, the dry land or the oceans?
Oceans.
All right, well, let's see. God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. Let it divide the waters from the waters. And then later he says, let the dry land appear. So Sylvia knows that I fixed this one because I messed it up at Bible B. So day three, the dry land appears, but it appeared out of the waters. So we had the oceans first. Now, what's interesting is your evolutionary bubbas say, the ungodly say, the dry land came first, then the oceans. They have it totally the opposite. They have the land first and then the oceans. Again, if you go from a hot molten blob to solid land, how do deep oceans form? Where do you get these deep trenches? You need something soft. You know, I've tried digging a fence post in hot Texas soil. Let me tell you what, you ain't getting very far. You ain't getting real far. What if it's a rock? How's the water going to create a canyon? How are you going to get any of that stuff? It's not going to happen. How are you going to get springs of water? It's just not going to be there. Okay, life created first on the land or in the oceans?
Ocean.
Some say oceans. What do you think? Where's the first place that life was created? Let's see. God said, let the earth bring forth grass and the herb yielding seed and the fruit tree yielding fruit. Have you ever seen plants grow in the bottom of the ocean? I haven't seen them in the ocean. I've seen them on land. See, there's some plants growing up. You plant some seeds, you watch it long enough, and boop, there it comes. Yeah. Oh, purple basil. Yeah, maybe that's your purple basil growing there, Katie. Well, the answer is it first came on the land. Now, the ungodly say the plants started in the ocean. Well, that doesn't work. How do you get a plant that needs light all the way at the bottom of a dark ocean canyon? How does it get light to photosynthesize? How does that come about? Because animals need something to eat, don't they? So what are they eating if there's not plants first? We've got all kinds of problems here, folks. We've got some significant problems. No animal or plant life I know today eats rocks. Right? You ever tried eating rocks? It doesn't work too well.
No.
No. That's good. Don't eat rocks, Kitty. All right. True or false? Plants were created before the sun. True or false?
Yes.
Who says true?
True.
Who says false?
True.
All right. That is true. God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb. So day three, you had the plants. And then day four, you had the light. So now what this means is that you've got a problem, again, if you're trying to show long ages for the days of creation. Because if you're trying to hold the Bible as true, and God made plants, and then later made a sun, that would mean these plants are sticking around for thousands of years before there's any sun to give them light. They would obviously die. But they can stay alive for one day without sun. That they could do. Well, then, so the answer is true. And the ungodly say the plants came a long, 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 long time after the sun. In fact, the sun would have baked that ground so hard, I don't know how anything would have cracked the ground to grow in it. It would have been like on a solid piece of granite. All right, next question. True or false? Fish came after birds.
False.
Okay. They both came together, didn't they? The waters brought forth moving creatures and the fowls that fly in the earth above the heaven. Now think about if you're a bald eagle and you like to eat fish. What are you going to do if there's no fish? You're going to have a hard time. You're going to be eating grass is what you're going to be doing. All right, so the ungodly say the fish crawled onto land and then decided to fly. That's what the ungodly say. Now, have you ever seen a fish crawl on land? I'll show you what he looks like. He looks like that. When the fish crawls on land, he dies. He doesn't go very far. You ever seen that fly? No, not unless somebody threw it over their shoulder in a fish shop or something, but that's not going to fly anytime soon. All right. Last question. After birds, I got two more questions. After birds, what did God make? After birds, God made... It says he made the beast of the earth and the cattle and everything that creeps upon the earth. He made the land animals of the sixth day. That's what he made. That's right. Yeah, there you go. Land animals of the sixth day. That's right. He made a bunch of land animals, didn't he? Now, the ungodly say this. The ungodly say the fish came first, and then the birds came, And then a giraffe came, and then a whale came. So that's kind of ridiculous. How do you go from a fish to a bird to a giraffe to a whale? Why would a giraffe want to all of a sudden go jumping back in the water and say, I think I'll be a big whale in the ocean? Why would we come out of the water, hang around on land, and go back? That is just absolutely ludicrous. That makes no sense.
It's time.
Yeah, time allegedly.
Try and think through it. You can't understand it.
That's right. You can't think through it. Right,
yeah,
right.
Katie answered this question. She said dinosaurs, too, on the sixth day.
Very good. Yep, that's right. True or false? Man lived with dinosaurs. True or false?
True.
True. Well, you know it's true. You don't have to say live. You can say we live with. You say, huh? Yeah. Here it says God made the beast of the earth, cattle, and everything that creeps upon the earth. That word creeping upon the earth refers to reptiles. That's what reptiles do. A lizard crawls around. Maybe you find them in the summertime. We had a bunch of lizards in Texas. And I'd catch them and I'd unfortunately kill them. But these things will keep growing if you don't kill them. If they keep getting plenty of food and water, they'll just grow and grow and get bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, interestingly enough, there is the ungodly, of course, say that dinosaurs died long before man. And they have all kinds of ideas as to why that happened. But you know what? There was a little boy fishing off the island of Madagascar. It's an island off the southeast part of Africa. He was fishing. And boy, something big got onto his line. He starts pulling this thing up. Oh, what is this thing? He's deep, deep fishing. He's pulling, pulling. And guess what he pulled up? He pulled up a coelacanth. I think I'm pronouncing that right. It was considered to be extinct. It was considered to be 70 million years old. It was considered to be a prehistoric creature. Lo and behold, a boy pulls it up and has it for his lunch. You caught a living fossil. In fact, you can go now to the down in D.C., the Museum of Natural History, and you can walk into their exhibit, and they will refer to it as, quote, a living fossil, unquote. They'll say it's 70 million years old, but they'll not acknowledge the fact that no, man lived with dinosaurs because we're living with one now. What's also interesting is that creature has four fins. I don't know if you can see it, but he's got two on top and two on the bottom that stick straight out. And they said, aha, see, that little animal is the first one that crawled up on land. He went sideways and he used those four fins to crawl up on land. Well, when they observed him in his natural habitat, you know what he did? He wasn't crawling. He was using it to upright his body, his head down, his tail up, and he would bounce around on the bottom of the ocean floor eating food. Much like you would see a goldfish do at the bottom of the tank. He just kind of pecks his way around, but he wants to do it for a long time. So those fins help him to stay upright and do that. They kind of navigate him around to do that. He's quite content to be at the bottom of the ocean. That's evidence for a bottom-feeding creature, not a land-crawling creature. So nobody told him he was extinct. He's still around. All right. So don't be fooled. That's the message. You can trust your Bible. Science simply hasn't caught up with the Bible. There's a lot they haven't learned yet. And you, in fact, are made in God's image. You're not a fish. Don't let anybody tell you you're a fish. You're not a fish, Samuel. You know that? Samuel's not a fish. You're not a fish. Are you a fish, Samuel?
No.
Samuel's not a fish.
I'm a fish.
Huh? You're not a fish. You're Samuel. Yeah, you're Samuel. That's who you are. All right. So that was a little thing for the kids. I hope you all enjoyed that.